Imagine her wearing a Chanel blazer with a big brooch. Nina, who passed away in 2010, was the Eileen Ford of the West Coast, the woman who made Cheryl Teagues and Christie Brinkley, who had launched the California blonde look. She was an institution. She warned me that I wasn't in Europe anymore. My scar could be a serious obstacle, but she was willing to represent me. I couldn't have been more astounded if she had sprouted gossamer wings and pulled out a magic wand. My journey had begun. Elated, I planned to return to the agency after a 2-week trip to New York. Before my meeting with Nina, I had done a little homework and made ambitious plans to weasel my way into all the big modeling agencies in New York. I would be in the capital of advertising and fashion, roaming Madison and 7th Avenues, so why not storm the offices of Eileen Ford, John Casablancas, and Wilhelmina? Nina advised me not to. I wasn't ready, she told me. I obeyed. In those days, you had a mother agency who groomed you and helped you build your modeling book of tear sheets for magazine editorials. And then that agency sent you to other markets they thought you could work in. They placed you at a sister agency and shared the commission. When I returned from the East Coast, I set off on a Friday for a meeting at Nina's agency, this time with proud mom in tow, to meet the rest of the team and receive my marching orders. Nina wasn't there that day, but her head of fashion, Jack somebody, was. He explained gingerly that my scar was not exactly a draw for editors and casting directors. We have to think of our bottom line, he said, as my elation faded and dejection replaced it. 11 minutes into my big meeting, I was headed back to the San Gabriel Valley. My mom was livid. That scar is not your fault, she said, with tears in her eyes. But any anger I might have felt took a back seat to my sense that modeling in Spain had all been a dream. I couldn't blame a modeling agency for being superficial. That was their business. All I understood was that in Spain, I was a woman, beautiful and confident. Back home, I was a young girl again, uneasy with herself, scarred and brown. I wallowed all weekend. Then on Monday, as soon as I knew her office was open, I called Nina and explained what had happened. She said that she would keep her word, as I had kept mine while in the Big Apple. Nina fought with Jack. She was the owner, after all, and she ultimately took me on. I wasn't expecting to be on the cover of Vogue, but I'm not sure I understood that the jobs I'd get in California would be commercials. My first job was a Folgers commercial, shot in L.A., but for the French market. I played one of the coffee groupies, wild for a caffeine-drinking man. For most of the day, I sat around and chatted with the other models. They regaled me with stories. One had just done a video with Prince. Another went on about modeling in Europe, not second-tier Europe, as she condescendingly referred to Madrid, but Paris and Milan. How fabulous it all seemed. After 3 days of essentially lounging around, I left with a really cool pair of jeans from the shoot and $3,600 cash. I had never seen so much at once. I folded up the bills and crammed the wad into my front pocket. One girl looked at the bulge with a raised eyebrow. "Why don't you put it in your purse?" she asked. "Because I want it close to me," I said. I liked the feeling of it against my thigh. Nina was a motherly presence in my life. When jobs or castings ended late, she'd insist that I stay the night in the spare room at her lavish, Mission Revival-style villa in the Hollywood Hills. She didn't want me driving home late. I'd never seen a house like hers. I ogled the Spanish tile, the turrets, and the spiral staircase. Her stunning lawn had no curry leaf or kumquat trees like my mom's, but I remember taking note of the St. Augustine grass. Peter had had a gardening business when he first arrived in the U.S., and St. Augustine grass, he always said, was the most resilient. When I had both an early morning and a late afternoon call, Nina would let me hang around in the office instead of having to trek home, only to trek back later. On those days, I'd bring lunch in a little igloo cooler and eat in the conference room. In an office full of lingerie ads and tape measures, I must have made for a strange sight, hunched over a Tupperware filled with one of my college staples. Top ramen stir-fried with curried flank steak. I've always felt like a truck driver trapped in the wrong body. Today, I eat straight from pans with my fingers. I overturn blenders, the dregs of sauces sliding slowly into my mouth. Home alone, I get in bed, perch a pizza box on my lap, and go at it, wiping my mouth on my sleeve. One day, I had just polished off one of my favorite lunches at the time, approximately half a loaf of bread layered with tomatoes, fresh basil, and fatty mozzarella doused with olive oil and balsamic vinegar, when a flamboyant Italian casting agent named Luigi came to the office. I just sucked down my last bite, fingers still greasy, when Luigi and Nina walked into the conference room. They sat down with a stack of portfolios. Luigi, I overheard as they flipped through them, was a scout from an agency in Milan. I quietly packed my stuff and had gotten up to slink out when he looked at me and asked, "What about her?" I was no longer the girl who'd shown up ashy for a casting. I had confidence. I knew how to hold my body and how to walk. My dark features would work in Italy, he thought. They certainly didn't serve me well in the U.S. Commercial work was about selling products, and the logic was you'd only buy the shampoo if you identified with the model lathering her hair in the shower. His agency would front the money to ship me to Milan and put me up in an apartment his agency kept for models. I'd pay them back from the work I did. Nina, to my surprise, said no. She said she wanted to save me for Paris. I had no idea if she really had this in mind for me or if it was some negotiating technique. Either way, I decided to go. I yearned to be somewhere where I felt beautiful and sophisticated as I had in Madrid. And at the very least, the opportunity meant I could finally move out of my mom's house in La Puente, the same old Carver-esque working-class neighborhood I had lived in throughout high school and that I had tried so hard to escape. The things I had seen and sampled, not only from my time in Madrid, but also from rubbing shoulders with the many international students at Clark University, had left me thirsty for a more cosmopolitan environment. And although Worcester, Massachusetts had been no London, Paris, or even New York, I had still been at an academic institution devoted to learning, close enough to New York City that I could drive or get there by train on the weekends. Once I was discovered by Luigi in Nina Blanchard's office, I didn't look back. One thing I knew, I was not going to move back in with my mother, ever. I would do whatever I needed to make my own way to a life for myself. While in Spain, I saw for the first time a world much larger than my mother or Peter's immigrant existence. My mother loved the theater and museums, but after moving to La Puente, we rarely went to any. I can remember only once going to a musical that had traveled from Broadway to Los Angeles, called, ironically, Sophisticated Ladies, composed by Duke Ellington. From the time I arrived at JFK at age 4 until we left for California in the early 80s, my mom and I had gone to many Broadway shows, including I Remember Mama, The Wiz, Chicago, Evita, and Ain't Misbehavin'. My mom would wait in line in the cold for discount tickets, somehow managing to find the pennies from her nurse's salary to pay for all those lovely excursions. I wanted museums, plays, and most of all, a place where there were lots of people from different backgrounds who would inspire me and from whom I could learn. I hoped I could make a living in Milan, but more importantly, I hoped somehow that even if the modeling didn't work out, which I had serious doubts it would, what with my scar and all, I would find a path that was right for me. I had gone to L.A. with little more than a B.A. in theater arts and a modeling portfolio, and after just a summer of pounding the pavement, it was pretty clear that opportunities for a girl like me were more elusive than they had been in Spain. I was eager to get back to Europe, where the notions of beauty and sex appeal were not as narrow. I arrived in Milan on October 6, 1992, just as its status as the center of the fashion world had nearly completed its descent. I'd be staying in the south of the city, far from the attractive center and well into the gray, sleepy industrial section. Luigi's agency put me up in a building called La Darsena, Italian for the dock, appropriate since it was the first port of call for new models in the city. It was like a low-rent version of the Barbizon Hotel, a repository for the thin and wayward. I had two roommates, a chirpy Brit who seemed more interested in men than in castings, and a seasoned American model with a been-there-done-that attitude. At the time, it didn't occur to me that if she were actually as experienced as she acted, she probably wouldn't have been sharing a one-bedroom apartment with two other girls. They slept on two twin beds. As the new girl, I was stuck with the sleeper sofa in the living room. Good thing I stayed in Milan for only 3 weeks. Yet its unglamorous beginning didn't extinguish the thrill of my new life. No longer was I a moonlighting student. I was living with other models because I, myself, was a real model. 3 days after I got there, Luigi and Kiko, his club promoter friend, told us to get ready because we were all going out for dinner. I remember asking whether we would be going somewhere expensive. If so, I'd politely bow out. My English roommate laughed. "I've never seen a bill," she said. Several cars pulled up in front of La Darsena, and a gaggle of girls filed out of the building, teetering on heels. My roommates were there, along with a 20-year-old from Australia, a 19-year-old from Germany, and a 16-year-old from Omaha, who I remember thinking should have been at home with her mom. At hardly 22, I was the oldest of the bunch. Dinner was at a pizzeria. This I was excited about. I had never met a pizza-related food I didn't like. English muffin pizzas, stromboli, cheese-filled calzones, those gloriously greasy New York slices I had had for lunch, 75 cents at the time and worth every penny. We sat down, and instead of Sprite, my typical pizza partner, we drank Chianti, deep red and tannic, with more weight than the Ernest and Giulio Gallo that my mom bought by the jug. Before we ordered, waiters arrived, with bread, crusty and warm, little bowls of almost syrupy olive oil that tasted of grass, and shards of Parmesan, like uncut diamonds. Before that night, I had thought Parmesan was a salty powder that came in a green shaker with a yellow top. These shards were altogether different, studded with crunchy crystals and sweet, with a funky dairy tang that overtook the back of my mouth, like chapati. I attempted to order pizza with pepperoni, siren of many a lapsed vegetarian. But when my pizza arrived, a whole pizza, nearly as big as my dinner plate, just for me, I found it was covered with marinated peppers. That was my first lesson in Italian. Here, pepperoni meant bell peppers. The lack of spicy meat wasn't the only difference between the irregular circle in front of me and the massive triangles I'd scarfed down in the States. While I expected pizza sauce, pasty and dark, I was met with a glorious, warm, pulpy liquid the color of a summer tomato, which lightly coated the pie. Rather than the golden ocean of cheese on top of that, there were just milky white tidal pools dotting its surface. And just as I was about to pick the whole thing up, I looked around to see my table mates going at their pies with forks and knives. One bite and I knew. This was the Chanel of pizza. I had only ever known the Gap. Around midnight, after demolishing the pizza and draining too many wine bottles, we crammed into the cars again and pulled up in front of Kiko's club, Madame Claude, named for the doyenne of the eponymous Paris brothel. Kiko led us as we strode in, a parade of thin, tall girls from all corners of the earth. We passed the waiting hordes, proud of our access and unaware that we were being sacrificed to the modelizers inside. We were led to velvet couches, and as if out of nowhere, our intoxicants arrived. We danced with one another, careful to avoid eye contact as the vultures began to circle. But as the night wore on and the drinks kept coming, I'd had plenty of Chianti, I definitely didn't need whiskey and cokes, I turned in to a vulture myself. I spotted Luigi at a table, chatting with two men, and went over to say hi. I'm still not sure what came over me, but I turned to one of Luigi's friends, pulled his folded-up tie from his pocket, and wrapped it around my neck like a scarf. My impishness was innocent. At 22 years old, I had no designs on this man, unremarkable but for his resemblance to Michael Douglas, circa Fatal Attraction, mixed in with a bit of Al Pacino, but in Dog Day Afternoon, not The Godfather Part II, and with about the same build. We danced all night, and I reveled in the excitement of being in a new country, with a new, unknown life about to unfold. This was the first man in Milan who courted me. Just 3 days after, I arrived from the U.S., and he did it with charm, and what I decided was the utmost panache. We met on a Thursday night, and he asked if he could give me a tour of the city and show me around that Saturday. He showed up at the agreed time, and when I got in the car, he had everything planned for the whole day. I had assumed we would just drive around and have lunch, and that would be it. We walked in the center of town, and he took me to see the Duomo. Then we went to the artists' district of Brera, to the Pinacoteca, to see works by Caravaggio, Raphael, and Rubens, but also to his favorite gelato place on Via Solferino. He took me to see designer boutiques I had only read about in Vogue, and then to a fast casual sandwich shop called Panino Giusto. He savored highbrow treats and lowbrow treats with equal gusto, and filled our day with a mix of both. Daniele, my Italian beau, and I would spend much of the next 6 years together. In Daniele, I saw so much of what I sought to be myself. He was worldly, sophisticated, and knowledgeable about art and culture. From the first, he had a huge effect both on the quality of my life in Europe and on how I saw myself. I had arrived in October with one large suitcase of clothes and $2,000, and that was it. By December, with the weather growing cold and my funds dwindling, he could see I needed a bit of sprucing up. Daniele very sweetly bought me a cashmere coat with a fur collar trim, one that I sorely needed. I had left my puffy jacket and my wool coat back in the States. In fact, in those first days after college, I still didn't even know the difference between a jacket and a coat. Daniele had lived in New York and spoke English well, so he corrected me. A coat, he said, went at least to the knees, whereas a jacket was only sport coat length, hitting at the thigh, or even higher, around the hips, like a baseball or leather bomber jacket. That was where Daniele's tutoring started, but there was way more he would school me in over the years. I spent most of my 20s in Italy, much of that time with Daniele. I had never experienced a life like Daniele's. His family had very deep roots in the textile-making community of Como in northern Italy. He had had a very privileged upbringing, and while he was a bit of an overgrown, spoiled rich kid, he did also work very hard. He partied the same way. Much of the 1990s, at least in the world of fashion, was a period of excess and debauchery for many of its inhabitants. And when you spend your time being judged for your body and nothing else, you sometimes need to leave it, or abuse it. I began to dip my toe in a world I could not have afforded or even fathomed just a short time earlier. My healthy fear of hurting my mother or my relatives in India kept me from ever developing a serious drug habit, but I was not immune to testing the limits. I felt uninhibited, free to experiment and do things I normally wouldn't do. I wanted to please Daniele as well. But only I am responsible for my actions, not anyone else, and there are certain nights I'd rather forget. I was eager to be an adult. I wasn't very experienced sexually, and when I wasn't sober, I felt free to do things I wouldn't normally do. It was the first time I had acted out my curiosities and fantasies. Some I regret, but not all, like knowing what it's like to touch and be touched by a woman. Not since I kissed two boys in one afternoon during a seventh-grade field trip to an amusement park had I been that promiscuous. But these bacchanalian evenings happened only once a month or so. Daniele's appeal lay more in how much he made me laugh. He had a fantastic sense of humor and a playful childlike streak. He was very creative and a good singer who played the harmonica like a pro and loved to dance. He dressed sharply, but in the understated Milanese uniform of jeans, blazer, crisp monogrammed shirt, and a simple Rolex. To be honest, a lot of this was lost on me at first. I didn't even understand how much Rolexes cost. In fact, I wouldn't have even been able to tell a Rolex from a Casio until he once pronounced that every well-dressed young woman should have a good watch, like a Rolex. He very sweetly gave me one on our first Valentine's Day together. All I remember thinking was that this small piece of stainless steel and glass had cost more than my mother made after taxes in a whole month as a nurse at the hospital. I was terrified I was going to break it. And at first, I wore it only when I was around him. Admittedly, it didn't take long for me to get more and more comfortable with this new, flashy life, in which I traveled back and forth from Milan to Paris for the weekend. I had moved to Paris 2 winters in a row to build my book, and then also down to Sardinia in the summer, where Daniele's folks had a house in Porto Cervo. But it wasn't just how to dress, or the lifestyle, or that Daniele taught me which fork to use, which he did. It was also the many excursions he took me on, to Florence, or Venice, or Rome. Daniele definitely was a hedonist, but he also had a serious bookish side. He was a voracious reader and understood so much about European art and history. It was a joy to hop around Europe and experience all the things firsthand. I was totally wide-eyed and savored every minute of all the schooling I was getting. I worked only a few days a week and often took a trip or two a month, getting an education that 4 years at Clark could never give me. I was coming from a pretty humble existence, and while college did expose me to the way others lived, I had been a financial aid student who was right back in her mom's house after graduation. For me, modeling was really a chance at sophistication, at becoming cultured and getting to see the world in a way I would never get to otherwise. Daniele's choosing to be with me also seemed a badge of sorts. He had lots of choices, and he had even invested in a modeling agency. Not mine, though. I had the good sense to keep my autonomy there. But he wanted to be with me. Being rejected early on at all those modeling castings was tough. Daniele was the perfect salve. In a way, Daniele gave me the courage to feel like I actually belonged at those castings, scar and all. In less than 6 months, I had gone from living with my parents after college and wondering how I was going to pay off all my student loans to going to La Scala, shopping at Kenzo, and eating at Bice. My head was spinning. My years in Europe shaped me as a woman. I don't really think any of us are women right when we turn 18, or even 21 for that matter. You have to live a little. I certainly tried to do that. It was amazing just to walk the streets in those cities. There's so much history in the buildings alone. In Paris, I studied how French women dressed, so casual yet put together and nonchalantly sexy, so individual and idiosyncratic somehow, even if they all shopped at the same stores. I studied the way Italian women walked, so feminine and playful, to some indecipherable beat that gave them both poise and sex appeal all at once. I was fascinated by the culture all around me. And I explored those two cities through my fork as well. In Milan, the brioche and other pastry in the mornings, always with cappuccino, suddenly made me a sweet eater. The pastas and meat dishes you could get at trattorias for a modest sum were simple in their preparation, but deliciously complex in the mouth. I learned the regional differences between the north and south and savored all the glorious seafood of Liguria. I never ate any fish until I got to Italy. Fish was the last frontier for my newfound carnivorousness to conquer. The first couple of years in Milan and Paris were surreal. I was in my early 20s, far from home in a new and exciting atmosphere, with the freedom to really look at who I was and who I wanted to be. I had grown up in a pretty conservative environment in my mother's home. My stepdad wouldn't even let a boy talk to me on our front lawn in broad daylight. I wasn't a rebellious teenager in high school and was too worried about how much college was costing us to even risk jeopardizing my studies thereafter. In Europe, I was alone, without my parents or family, so I made my own decisions, and for the first time in my whole life, money was not a constant issue. I wasn't making that much in that first year or two as a model, but compared with what my parents and I had to live on, I barely needed to work a couple of days to meet my month's expenses. It was an unbelievable turn of events in the history of my short life. Chapter 7. I joined a new agency that sent me to Paris to build my book, after just 1 month of being in Milan. The apartment I lived in, on Rue du Chemin Vert in the Bastille neighborhood, was no better than the one I'd left behind in Milan. I shared 2 rooms with 4 other girls, all models, all wretched, in debt to our agency for rent and the pittance they advanced us for living expenses, and on a seemingly impossible hustle for work to pay it off. I went on endless castings and go-sees, where you'd go to see an editor or photographer in the hopes that they'd take a shine to you, clutching my modeling book as I waited in line with 200 other girls, only to have the kingmaker in question flip through my book without so much as looking me in the eye. I'd race from one go-see and casting to the next. At my low level, sometimes you'd get a job because you were the first hireable girl to arrive. But at least I was in Paris. At least after I left castings dejected, I could walk through the Place Vendôme or the Jardin des Tuileries, admiring the city, even if I didn't feel a part of it. The endless castings forced me to experience Paris by metro and by foot, to wend my way through immigrant neighborhoods, past slivers of restaurants selling goat curry, down alleys packed with Chinese shops selling tea, ginger, and fresh cilantro, even in February. I'd scurry by butcher shops, averting my eyes and wishing I could unsee the skinned rabbits and lambs hanging in the windows, eyes still in their sockets, or the pigs' heads, each wearing a strange smirk. I had only just started eating meat a few years prior, and as far as I was concerned then, it should only come nestled in styrofoam trays and wrapped in plastic. To buoy my spirits, I spent the little money I had trying to buy a small piece of Paris through its food. While I couldn't really afford to eat out very much, I could afford to roam Paris's markets and cafes if I watched my budget. Just a hunk of cheese with good bread and olives were all I needed. Cheese and olives smashed between flanks of a crisp baguette was the perfect combination of umami and chatpati in one starchy, crumbly bite. The spicy, sour spike in the various olives I found, from small black, oily Greek ones to big, chili-drenched Moroccan ones, was the perfect, salty counterpoint to the fatty and sharp cheeses of France. If the heel of the baguette became a bit dry, I would drizzle drops of the seasoned brine or oil from the olive bags on top to soften the bread. There were endless varieties of cheese to sample. Week by week, I slowly made my way from the mild and familiar to the more sinister, stinkier, runnier sections of the cheese counter. It was in Paris that I first discovered goat cheese, or chèvre, by accident. I had eaten the chived-up cow's milk cheese Bourzan, which is sold in American supermarkets, and thought that's what I was buying when I pointed to the creamy mound in the cheese shop. But instead of the cream-cheesy soft richness of that herby wonder, I discovered the sublime, grassy tang of goat cheese. Before that, my only taste of goat cheese had been Greek feta. I was in love with French cheese. And so, I made friends with the large sweaty cheesemonger in the Bastille street market, who would bray at me with raised fingers on his shiny head for goat's cheese, or pull imaginary teats for Brie de Meaux. This tall, paunchy man, a doppelganger for Alfred Hitchcock, in a tablecloth-sized white apron spread across his enormous belly, had huge, wide hands with pink sausages for fingers. The broken capillaries on his cheeks and nose bulged as he barked at me to stop loitering and fogging up his glass case. Often a swarming knot of irate French housewives and maids formed behind me while I tried hard to pick just one cheese. There were so many to choose from, and so few francs with which to buy them. Back home at the Amar Ranch Market, we basically had the choice of mozzarella, American singles, or Wisconsin mild, sharp, and extra sharp cheddar. For spaghetti, we sprinkled Parmesan out of a dark green Kraft cylinder. If we went to Stater Brothers Supermarket, farther out in West Covina, which was slightly more middle-middle class than the lower-middle class of La Puente, we could score Swiss, provolone, or Munster. French cheese to us was laughing cow. Cheese was either white or orange. But in Paris, in the Bastille, cheese was blue, beige, veiny, creamy white, yellow, deep sunset orange, or even burnt sienna. It came crusted with rose-colored peppercorns, smelling of funk, and swathed in ash and wax. My love of cheese was liberated. I perused and savored all the milky delights I had never before seen or tasted. As weeks went by, my French improved ever so slightly, and I would stammer questions at that impatient beast of a cheesemonger. To preserve his business from dwindling, he took to pushing me to the side in order to service those who did know what they wanted. Because I was probably pathetic, and because he could most likely see the hunger in my eyes, often while cutting a wedge for those sharp-elbowed women, he would throw a razor-thin slice or crumbled edge my way. He never looked at his hands while wielding his knife or sharp violin string of a cheese cutter, and yet the amount was always perfect. He was not kind and he was not chatty, but if I stood there, quietly, he would ply me with a steady stream of cheesy samples. "So, what wins the prize today?" he would grumble, to indicate he had given me enough. Some days, if I was especially lucky, he would give me the leftover scraps of cheeses that were too small to sell, even in the bargain basket, of 4 or 5 franc wrapped chunks. I took whatever he threw my way, and eventually relished even the most intense Roquefort, or the runniest Camembert, waxy rind and all. I didn't have more than 8 or 10 francs to spend on any given meal anyway. One day, the agency's unhappy accountant called me in to discuss my purchases. After what might have been the first talking to a model has ever received for eating too much cheese, I slunk out, chastened and worried for my Camembert habit. Thank goodness, then, for Michael Spingler, from whom I learned the principles of French cooking. He was a French literature professor at Clark, and while I'd never taken a class with him, his wife, Kathy, worked as the costume director for the theater department and had employed me as a costume apprentice. I adored Kathy. And Michael happened to be in Paris on sabbatical with his family, working on a book about Molière. He knew I was struggling and had me over for dinner often. Michael showed me a Paris different from the one I'd seen, which had been beautiful but cold and full of disappointment. His building was in the 14th arrondissement, at 139 Rue d'Alésia, if memory serves. The building's owner, Jean-Claude, was a literary critic for Le Monde, its handyman, a German poet. They were all friends with Leo, the owner of a nearby bookstore called Alias. Everyone except Leo lived in the building, for the most part with their doors open. Jean-Claude, a tall man with approximately 10 hairs left on his head, all-white ones, wire-framed spectacles, and a small roster of moth-eaten sweaters would show up for dinner with a pot of beans and lardons. Michael would make magic with his two-burner stove. It was there that I ate my first blanquette de veau, my first veal of any sort, for that matter. The French bistro classic that featured the slowly cooked meat doused in a sauce rich with stock and cream. I ate lamb shank braised in red wine, and nearly everything, steaks, green beans, fish, was finished with plenty of butter. In Michael's hands, even the simplest food became special. We didn't eat mere mashed potatoes. No, we ate pommes de purée de terre. He'd make Jean-Claude peel the potatoes. Jean-Claude was in the army, Michael would say. He won't mind. To come home from those dispiriting casting calls, to the heady aromas of his tiny kitchen, or to Michael and Jean-Claude sipping wine beside an ashtray brimming with the butts of unfiltered Gauloise cigarettes, was exactly what I needed. To climb the wide marble staircase to the fifth floor and enter the spacious apartment crowded with tattered furniture, dusty oriental rugs, and miles of dog-eared books, to see these two thinkers semi-drunkenly discussing Baudelaire was a much-needed balm for my aching feet and spirit. I'd kick off my high heels, sink into a chair, and receive a glass of red and a warm welcome. "And how was today's foray into the forest of fashion?" Jean-Claude might say in heavily accented English, exaggerating his F's. Michael and Jean-Claude saw the toll the fashion business was taking on me, and they fought it valiantly, deploying a daily barrage of gentle teasing. When I came in crushed after failing to score a commercial modeling gig, probably half a page in some newspaper insert, they expressed mock disappointment in me. "How terrible you are," Jean-Claude would say, and Michael would chime in, "I agree, you're definitely not good enough to sell Maylocks." They poked fun at my self-pity. "One day your grand moment will come," says Jean-Claude. "You will have your face on the pantyhose package at Monoprix." I had my own peanut gallery. That is how I survived the parade of rejections, inevitable for most wannabe models, and the myopia of a young person's passion. They reminded me that there was more to life than being pretty. I spent more and more time on Rue de Alésia as my apartment became bedlam. One day, I came home to find that someone had drunkenly peed in my bed. I was paying for a soiled bed in an apartment I rarely used. I cried when I told Michael. He invited me to move in. This was when my real life in Paris began. Work came in a trickle, a fitting model gig here, a catalog shoot there. But the occasional job was all I needed to support my modest lifestyle. I certainly wasn't partying like a model. When my former roommates were out at Le Bain Douche, the French equivalent of Madame Claude, guzzling free champagne with other trucked-in models, I was with my weeknight family, Michael, his friends, and when they came to visit, Kathy and their two kids, eating coq au vin and drinking Pinot Noir. When the weekend came, I was off to Milan to see Daniele, or Monsieur Spaghetti, as Jean-Claude dubbed him. I was living as charmed a life as anyone sleeping on a literature professor's couch could hope to. Michael and Jean-Claude used to heckle me as I packed my bag. "Going away for your dirty weekend?" "No!" "Well, isn't he your lover?" "Ew, stop!" As embarrassed as I was, I felt grateful to have these two men in my life who felt protective enough to embarrass me. I got to know the Friday night pilots, who would let me sit in the cockpit's third seat for takeoff and landing on the short flight to Milan. They'd point out the rabbit holes near the runway at Charles de Gaulle and curse the rabbits for getting caught in the plane's wheels. The airport staff was occasionally invited to hunt them. My pilot friends boasted of the stews they'd make. When I landed back in Paris on Sundays, I'd look out the window for the animals' eyes, glowing from the reflected lights of the plane. Daniele's mom, Gabriella, a big-bosomed, always carefully coiffed woman with a weakness for furs and skinny cigarettes the size of lollipop sticks, opened my eyes to a sort of Italian cooking much different from the spaghetti and meatballs version produced by Pompeii Pizzeria, the restaurant run by my friend Pelli Demopoulos's family, where I had my first job at 15. In those days, you could get an age waiver at 14 from the Department of Labor to have a part-time job after school. If your grades were good enough, the school would sign a document, and you were exempt from waiting until the legal age of 16 to work. I watched, surprised at first, as Gabriella opted for butter instead of olive oil and often chose bechamel over tomato sauce. I had received my Italian food education at Pompeii Pizzeria back home, and a year later at Pelli's uncle's pizzeria, Mario's, where the tips were better. There, garlicky tomato sauce reigned. Yet Daniele's mother mainly cooked the style of food found in northern Italy and Milan in particular, which meant risotto, tinted yellow from saffron and rich with marrow, accompanied by ossobuco slowly cooked with white wine and stock. Sometimes it reminded me more of French food than Italian. When we went out to eat, they would discuss whether to go for food from Emilia-Romagna, Tuscany, or Liguria, as my friends and I back home might debate whether to eat Chinese burgers or Mexican. I knew Indian food was highly regional, but India was a vast country of close to a billion people. I quickly learned that Italy, though comparatively tiny, had no less regional variation. Daniele's family was full of voracious eaters. Before I had taken a third bite of my veal milanese, incredibly juicy and encased in crispy breading, they were sitting in front of empty plates, watching politely and with evident pride, as I savored every buttery moment. Between Gabriella and Michael, I got a vast education in European cooking. I learned how to make more than just curry and stir-fry, to cook without relying on mountains of chopped onions, garlic, and ginger. Occasionally, I'd pitch in to do more than chop onions. In February, I came home giddy from the supermarket because I found fresh cilantro. Michael was roasting a lamb shank for dinner, so I made an almost and pretty darn close replica of the cilantro chutney of my childhood to drizzle onto the meat. Daniele spoke perfect English, but taught me to speak real Italian in the way only a boyfriend can. When we met, I spoke enough Spanish to piece together what Italian said to me. Within a few months, though, I could fight with him in rapid Italian. Through our life together and from chatting with cab drivers, I came to understand both the expressive and the banal. Che cazzo! A cabbie would yell after getting cut off. C'è lo mal di stomaco, Daniele would say right before chugging Maalox. About once a month, Daniele and I would spend an entire Sunday at the movies. We'd see an early movie, have lunch, catch an afternoon movie, then have a snack, and finish with a late show after dinner. These weren't all Roberto Benigni films, of course. For years, I thought Steven Seagal was an amazing actor, because the guy who dubbed him in Italian was a brilliant stage actor who also dubbed De Niro. Daniele and I live near the Duomo, the city's stunning cathedral, and we often walked past it on our way to the movies. There was no cathedral adorned with thousands of centuries-old statues back in La Puente. There were no skyscraping Gothic spires either. Daniele cultured me in the way a partner often does. In the person you care for, you often see parts of the person you wish you were. In Daniele, I saw a man raised around what I knew cerebrally to be great art, the kind you read about in college. He knew it not as something to be studied, but as something to be seen and felt, not as something rare to be viewed only after a long plane ride, but something beautiful that happened to be right down the street. That proximity to art and culture was part of what I had missed when we moved away from New York. Now I had a chance to live walking distance from the Santa Maria della Grazia, where the Last Supper hangs. I was a train ride away from both Michelangelo's sculpture of David in Florence and the Colosseum and Pantheon in Rome. From Daniele, I learned so much about Italian food, in the quotidian way you do when your days and nights together are full of pumpkin ravioli, swimming in sage butter. He meticulously planned our movie times and snacking. Pre-movie lunch might be at Pizzeria Gambarotta. Then, after movie number one, Spuntini at the Lux Cafe Cova, with its ceiling dripping with chandeliers, for little sandwiches of arugula, goat cheese, and leathery bresaola, or cured beef, and some pastel-colored pastries fit for Marie Antoinette. I loved eating in tiny portions, the opposite of my experience in America. Even my Coca-Cola came in a miniature glass bottle. After movie number two, we were off to dinner at Il Rigolo, the Tuscan trattoria we went to every Sunday, and possibly the only place in the world to offer lasagna al curry. This cracked me up, and I ordered it often, a bechamel-heavy stack of pasta stained yellow with turmeric. Only occasionally did I look for these reminders of home and my food. For the most part, I embraced the new and unfamiliar, in the way you do when you're young and captivated by a life different from the one you've always known. I did, however, order my pasta arrabbiata as angry as they could make it. For an Indian girl, their spicy was never quite spicy enough. Somehow, our favorite lunch in Milan during movie days was at the nearby McDonald's. Ah, Italy, where modernity and antiquity exist side by side. Where I lay into un Big Mac and a side of patatine fritte. Besides treating his money-strapped girlfriend to fine food, Daniele also upped my sartorial game. Textiles were his family's business, and he had his own operation, making and selling printed fabric. He did, quote, research constantly, by which I mean he shopped. I'd tag along for his sessions where he'd buy whatever inspired him and send it to the fabric factory for a few days to be studied, and some aspect of it replicated. He'd always buy whatever it was in my size, so after he was done with it, I'd get to wear it. He had great taste. I had my own style, a hodgepodge of vintage bargains and a few splurges from Contempo Casuals or Express, but he gently challenged those choices. He taught me the subtle and not-so-subtle precepts of fashion, the unspoken rules that no one had ever codified for me before. A very short skirt and heels were overkill. If I liked a sweater or pants, he'd politely check the tag to identify the fabric. This isn't good quality, he'd explain, or this won't keep you warm. Daniele made sure I had the staples. Just as a good home cook needs to have high-quality olive oil, nice vinegar, and a heavy sauté pan, a girl needs a dress coat, real leather boots, and a nice watch. And just as it's impossible to go back to cheap balsamic after tasting the good stuff, it's hard to slip on rayon once you've worn cashmere. 3 months into our relationship, he took me for the weekend to the Swiss ski resort St. Moritz, where his family had a house. Our first night there, he hired a horse and sleigh to drive us across the frozen lake. With snow-capped alpine peaks in the background, he proposed to me. As romantic a gesture as this seemed to be, and as doe-eyed as I was, I had no problem saying no. I was naive, not stupid. I cared for him, but I was too young to marry anyone, especially someone, and God knows I see the comedy in this now, 17 years older than me. In fact, marriage didn't figure into my girlish fantasies at all. From my mom's 3 marriages, I inherited a skepticism toward the institution, with its till death do us part commitment. I promised to marry him one day, adding, if all goes well, so I would have plenty of wiggle room. That's how I said no. And so the relationship sailed on, ultimately for 6 years, as if nothing had happened. I was in love and just happy in the way you are when you're young. The future felt far, far away. Commitment is easy before a relationship requires compromise and obligation. I felt wise then, proud of my man and his sophistication, the complete opposite of my mother's latest choice in a mate. Somewhere inside, I knew it wouldn't last. The relationship was one, ultimately, of contented convenience. We stayed together because we were reasonably happy and because there was no good reason to split up. A year had passed since I arrived in Europe, and not much had changed. I was making ends meet with the huge help of having no rent to pay when in Milan, but the work had become increasingly tiresome. I was no stranger to rejection by this point. There were several explanations for this. I wasn't a particularly gifted model. The waif phenomenon was in full swing, and I was a relatively voluptuous 34-24-34. Yet I couldn't help but see all those no's, or more accurately, the lack of any response at all, as a referendum on my scar. I was bored of the shame I felt, of people's furtive downward glances when I went sleeveless, of the inevitable questions the scar invited. I was tired of the requisite disclosures when I went on castings. "Before we begin, let me show you my hideous scar." I saw an obvious ceiling to my achievement. I accepted that I would only get so far with my aesthetic handicap. So I made an appointment to undergo chemical dermabrasion to take some of the dark pigment out of the scar. This wasn't the first time I'd tried to reduce its visual impact. Before I had cold-called Nina Blanchard's agency, I visited an Indian surgeon named Dr. Raj Kanodia in L.A., recommended to me by another model. He told me that while he couldn't erase the scar, he could significantly flatten it, making it easier to hide with makeup. "This might be uncomfortable," he said, before inserting a needle as long as an asparagus spear and withdrawing it excruciatingly slowly to ensure an even distribution of Kenalog. The injection did flatten the scar, but left me terrorized. Now, after a year in Milan, my agency identified a doctor. Agencies had Rolodexes filled with doctors who could fix anything from teeth to tits. This doctor treated it inch by inch as I gritted my teeth and cried. This was primitive dermabrasion, essentially a controlled chemical burn, a painful stripping of layers of tissue, which I hope has improved since the early 90s. I had never known such agony, even during painful monthly periods and in the car accident itself. But the procedure worked. After a dozen sections, about half an inch of the scar had been visibly pruned of a few layers of knobby tissue and now was a neutral color, close to that of the rest of my arm. My agency sent me for a go-see with the agent Davide Manfredi, who was looking to cast the next photo series for a photographer named Helmut Newton. Art lovers, fashion industry types, and Vogue magazine devotees, they all knew Helmut Newton. I'd first heard of him when I was in college. In the same league as Irving Penn and Richard Avedon, he was a trailblazing photographer who made his own rules. Mr. Newton urged fashion photography from the restrained toward the provocative, a big deal at the time for a demure industry. A Vogue editor reportedly admonished him, "Ladies, Helmut, do not lean against lampposts." He was perhaps best known at the time for his series Big Nudes, unflinching, elegant portraits of women who were completely nude, but for a pair of high heels. Being chosen as his subject was a potentially career-making job. When my turn with Davide came, I entered his office with familiar trepidation. He told me to strip to my underwear. I was neither surprised nor entirely comfortable. I had been modeling for a year and was more or less immune to the humiliation of being photographed in this state. It had become only mildly unpleasant, like getting blood drawn. At least by now, I knew enough to shave first. As I undressed behind a partition, I gave him my requisite scar spiel, half expecting him to tell me to put my clothes back on. "Don't worry, Helmut likes scars," he said. He took a few Polaroids, affixed them to a piece of paper, and faxed them, along with hundreds of others, to Mr. Newton in Monte Carlo. The audition came and went. I thought little about it because I didn't for a second expect to get it. I was a bench warmer for my agency. Once in a while, when a job came in that wasn't commercial, they called me in to take a swing. I had a better shot at scoring that kind of job, where the model would be the subject of art rather than a consumer aspiration. While an ad exec would not see my, quote, exotic look as relatable, the artist might at least see it as fun to photograph. My career so far had been an elaborate game of pretend. I was a model who barely got work, who existed on the lowest rung of the business, and who saw no indication of that changing. I was still effectively in debt to Luigi for the plane ticket to Milan and to City Models in Paris. Somewhere in me, I understood that the farce would soon end, and I would move back home, go to grad school, and hopefully find a real job. As a result, I was only partly present during my auditions and shoots. As I stripped for Davide, I felt as if I were role-playing, as if I were looking through someone else's eyes. 2 weeks later, I got a call from my agency. They informed me that Mr. Newton wanted to book me for a private commission. Me! Perhaps the coolest part? He loved my scar. The minute he saw it, Davide later told me, the great photographer said, I have to photograph her. My agent was thrilled, of course, almost shocked. Everyone at the agency seemed genuinely happy. The underdog had won one. I was an MFA student getting a story in The New Yorker. This could be the job that launched me from an unknown model with a funny name to a model with a funny name that bookers recognized. Instead of just being one of 300 models on a casting call, now I'd be one of 40. If I were able to say I worked with Mr. Newton, it would no longer matter that I wasn't the most beautiful or talented model in the business. Once you graduate from Harvard, does anyone really care about your GPA? Get through this, my agent promised, and I could forever sport his imprimatur. The subtext for me was that my scar, that indelible blot on my body, would effectively be erased. Once the excitement faded, I began to confront what the shoot would entail. Mr. Newton, I learned, had been privately commissioned by a Japanese businessman to do a sort of big nudes redux. It was not to be published or exhibited, but merely hung, perhaps in his dining room. I'd have to be naked. To get a sense of how naked, Daniele and I went to a bookstore. Lo, those heady pre-internet days, to look at Mr. Newton's books. As I flipped the pages, I understood that this wasn't strategically placed fabric naked. It was full-blown, oh my, that's your vagina, naked. I was terrified of posing completely nude. I was a child of conservative India, where women went to the beach in their saris. My grandfather was still alive. He would not be happy. I also hated the idea of a photo of my poontang hanging in some banker's dining room. Now I realize that this was an odd reaction, but for some reason I'd rather have had thousands of people staring at my body than just that one. Vag was the final frontier, the thing you still didn't see on TV or in mainstream ads and media. Italian magazines like Max and others did show fully nude models, and many respected Italian actresses and TV personalities had gone full frontal by then, some more artistically than others. Later, I would do Max magazine, but that was still to come. At that moment in time, in 1993, just showing my boobs with both nipples blazing seemed like a crossing of some Rubicon in itself. My body tensed as Daniele and I leafed through the pages of one of Newton's books. Daniele noticed. You should only do it if you're comfortable, he said. If you're not, it'll show. He was right. You can fake being bubbly for a Folgers shoot. You can fake the obligatory stoic look of the runway. But when you're entirely exposed, the camera won't be fooled. And I couldn't go all the way to Monte Carlo on this legendary photographer's dime to be a disappointment. Yet whenever I thought I'd finally decided to demur, the infectious thrill among my colleagues and my agency pulled me back into, quote, maybe land. Perhaps I was just nervous. I didn't want my fear to torpedo such a huge opportunity. I spoke to my mother, who has never been prudish. She raised me not to be ashamed of my body and to appreciate the female form and celebrate it. We both routinely went naked around the house when there weren't others around. And I never saw my mom behave as if she were ashamed of her own body, no matter what. We even went to a nude beach once in San Diego.